This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's gay and lesbian community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or www.pdxgayyellowpages.com.
Supported free radio station, KBOO. Okay, I understand I'm now broadcasting. This is Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and it's 9:34 in the morning here on the Pacific Coast. Well, just when you thought you'd seen all the tricks from the Bush administration, Bush hid his discredited Social Security privatization plan in this year's budget proposal. Remember that one? That was going to be, let's see, in the first year of private accounts, people would be allowed to divert up to 4% of their wages covered by Social Security into what Bush called voluntary private accounts. The maximum contribution to such accounts would start at $1,100 annually and rise by $100 a year through 2016. You thought that was over and done with, huh? No, he snuck it in the budget. On page 321 of the budget, according to the Washington Post, you see privatization costs, that'd be $24 billion in fiscal 2010, $57 billion in fiscal 2011, and another $630 billion for the 5 years after that, for a seven-year total of $712 billion. You know, you start stacking up a few hundred billion here and a few hundred billion there, and after you, before you know it, you're talking real money. So, the latest hoo-ha seems to be about cartoons, and much of the Muslim world is offended by a series of cartoons, and the way it's been reported here, you'd think that they're all just very unreasonable, but anyone who's been following the news at all will recall that there have been a few things like Sabra and Shatila and Fallujah and just so many massacres and bombings and torturings and imprisonments and humiliations and invasions that I suppose you could call cartoons the last straw. But why these cartoons? Well, perhaps you had heard that one of them showed the prophet with a bomb in his turban. There was a lot more to it than that. From prisonplanet.com, the possible inorganic manufactured nature of the riots has to be seriously considered. The three most offensive cartoons that caused the outrage were not even printed in the Danish newspaper. Let's see, Jyllands-Posten, I think you'd say. But were added in and handed out by Danish imams who circulated the images to brethren in Muslim countries, according to the London Telegraph. It also appears highly suspicious that Muslims in Gaza City and other places had gained access to a plentiful supply of Danish flags to burn in front of the waiting world media as soon as the controversy broke out. Ted Rawls, who is also a cartoonist, wrote in Common Dreams, adding fuel to the fire, according to the Times, were a group of Denmark's fundamentalist Muslim clerics who took their show on the road last fall, traveling around the Middle East showing a package that included cartoons that had never actually appeared in any newspaper, some depicting Muhammad as a pedophile, a pig, or engaged in bestiality. Yeah, it's not just the bomb in the hat thing. A pedophile, a pig, or engaged in bestiality. Newspapers in France, Germany, and elsewhere further fanned the flames by reprinting the Danish drawings, but there's something going on under the surface here, and I think the something going on is provocations for war. And speaking of provocations for war, from the Wayne Madsen Report, they comment that they previously reported on the activities of a group of some 120 Israeli art students in the United States prior to the 9/11 attacks. At least a year before the attacks, the art students, so-called, caught the attention of agents of the Drug Enforcement Administration, who prepared a lengthy report of their activities in June 2001. The DEA report specifically concluded that the Israelis may have had ties to an Islamic fundamentalist group. That group turned out to be Al-Qaeda. The DEA report was supplemented by reports from agents of the Marshall Service, Environmental Protection Agency, and local police departments. Wayne Madsen's report on the suspicious activities of Israeli art students and movers concludes that these individuals were involved in surveillance of the 911 hijackers in locations such as Hollywood, Florida, Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, Venice, Florida, Laurel, Maryland, San Diego, California, and Jersey City and Paterson, New Jersey. An Israeli intelligence veteran has confirmed to Wayne Madsen report that Israeli art students who shadowed the 911 hijackers were part of a major Mossad intelligence operation. A long-serving member of the Israeli intelligence service has confirmed that the art students were in fact part... Oh, I just said that. And that they were conducting surveillance of the activities of the 911 hijackers. They also worked with the Israeli Urban Moving System employees in New Jersey and were seen in at least two New Jersey locations, Liberty State Park and the Doric Apartment Building, celebrating the impact of the first plane into the World Trade Center. The Israelis at Liberty State Park were dressed in Arab-style clothing when they were witnessed celebrating the first attack. The FBI later confiscated a videotape they filmed of the first attack. All the Israeli art students and movers who were detained, arrested, or jailed were freed and allowed to return to Israel. The Israeli movers in New Jersey were freed after intense pressure was brought on the Bush administration by Rudolph Giuliani. After the news of the Israeli art students and their intelligence ring was reported by the AP and other media outlets, including Fox News, the Israeli embassy in Washington and the Washington Post called the story an urban myth. It is also of note that John Miller, the ABC News reporter who covered the Israeli mover story for 2020 and concluded that the movers were not involved in the 911 attacks, is now the spokesman for the FBI. Yeah, funny that. Also from Wayne Madsen report, there are a number of FBI agents, some veterans of the New York-New Jersey Joint Terrorism Task Force, who know about the Israeli role in surveillance of the 911 hijackers but have been gagged by senior levels of the FBI not to talk about what they know. By the way, WayneMadsenReports.com wins the prize for the website most likely to be so hacked by outside forces that it messes up my computer. From Jeremy Scahill on Alternet, while Cindy Sheehan was being dragged from the House gallery moments before President Bush delivered his State of the Union address for wearing a T-shirt honoring her son and the other 2,200 U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq, Turki Al-Faisal was settling into his seat inside the gallery. Al-Faisal Asadi is a man who has met Osama bin Laden and his lieutenants on at least five occasions, describing the al-Qaeda leader as quite a pleasant man. He met multiple times with Taliban leader Mullah Muhammad Omar, yet unlike Sheehan, Al-Faisal was a welcomed guest of President Bush on Tuesday night. He is also a man that the families of more than 600 victims of the 911 attacks believe was connected to their loved ones' deaths. If you can see where I'm going with this, there's more and more dirt coming up about 911, and it confirms my opinion that it was a setup. It was allowed and even encouraged to happen by the Bush administration. It was in the works for a while, evidently, and I think that we need to look at this carefully because it worked really well for the Bush administration, and no doubt, since it ain't broken, they won't fix it. In other words, more of this is likely to come down, especially since they evidently want to attack Iran at some point. Continuing with Scahill's article, Al-Faisal, well, I guess before I continue, I might point out that Faisal is a Saudi royal name going way back, and there are lots of royal, well, scumbags named Faisal, deeply brutal people, dictators, but kings, actually, in this day and age. And going back to the 20th century. But anyway, Al-Faisal is actually Prince Turki Al-Faisal, a leading member of the Saudi royal family and the kingdom's current ambassador to the United States. But the bulk of his career was spent at the helm of the feared Saudi intelligence services from 1977 to 2001. Last year, the New York Times pointed out that he personally managed Riyadh's relations with Osama bin Laden and Mullah Muhammad Omar of the Taliban. Yep, that's the New York Times. That's Turki Al-Faisal, and that's Omar and bin Laden. Returning to the article, anyone else who had dealings with even a fraction of the notorious characters the prince has worked with over the years would never make it past the U.S. immigration counter, let alone to the most exclusive offices in Washington. And that's from the New York Times. That's the end of the quote. Al Faisal was also named in the $1 trillion lawsuit filed by hundreds of 911 victims' families who accused him of funding bin Laden's network. Curiously, his tenure as head of Saudi intelligence came to an abrupt and unexpected end 10 days before the 911 attacks. Nobody explained the circumstances under which he left, says Assad Abu Khalil, author of The Battle for Saudi Arabia. We know for sure that he was tasked by the United States government back in the late 70s and on to assemble the kind of Arab-Muslim fanatical volunteers to help the United States and the CIA in the fight against the Soviet communist regime in Afghanistan. In the course of doing that, this man is single-handedly the most responsible for the kind of menace that these fanatic groups now pose to the world peace and security. Actually, it said fanatical. I don't get why there's an extra syllable on that if you mean fanatic. Well, who cares? Yet there Al-Faisal sat on Tuesday as President Bush spoke of his war on terror, and Cindy Sheehan was being booked. At one point, the cameras even panned directly on Al-Faisal listening intently to Bush. The 911 family's lawsuit charged that Al-Faisal secretly traveled to Kandahar twice in 98, where he met with bin Laden's representatives and Taliban leader Mullah Muhammad Omar. Based on sworn testimony from Taliban intelligence chief Mullah Kakshar, a lawsuit claimed that Al-Faisal allegedly, or let's just call him Turkey, allegedly received assurances that Al-Qaeda would not use the infrastructure in Afghanistan to subvert the royal family's control of the Saudi government. In return, according to the lawsuit, the Saudis promised not to seek bin Laden's extradition or the closing of his training bases. Turkey also, well, I guess that's confusing. If I call him Turkey, it might sound like the country. Okay, so Turkey Al-Faisal also allegedly promised Mullah Omar financial assistance. Shortly after the meetings, the Saudis reportedly shipped the Taliban 400 new pickup trucks. According to the London Observer, Kakshar also said that Al-Faisal arranged for donations to be made directly to Al-Qaeda and bin Laden by a group of wealthy Saudi businessmen. Mullah Kakshar's sworn statement implicates Prince Turkey as the facilitator of these money transfers in support of the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and international terrorism, according to the lawsuit. Al-Faisal does not deny he traveled to Afghanistan in 98 for meetings with Mullah Omar, but insists it was to convey an official Saudi request to extradite bin Laden. Al-Faisal has a long history in Afghanistan. He worked closely in the 80s with both the CIA and the Mujahideen that would later form both Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So again, to the point, the corruption goes further than you could possibly imagine. And if you combine that with the information coming out about the evident detonation of the World Trade Centers, we've been had. I want to bring it all to a gestalt of what kind of world we live in right now. Frankly, we are occupied by a dictatorship that promotes corporations. This is known as fascism. It's a friendly fascism so far for most of us, certainly not for those who were illegally and improperly detained just for having Arabic names. Certainly not for an American citizen who was held for years without a charge. Certainly not for any one of our family, our group of citizens on this part of this continent who, well, like one fellow I saw as I was doing my job the other night, driving a bus late at night, parked his wheelchair next to a bus bench and slumped over because that's the best we can do for him. All those billions going to war and going to the pockets and out of the pockets and through into other pockets and $9 billion missing, and you know what I'm talking about. Corruption, fascism, and what are we going to do about it? You know, fascism depends on intimidation. We've seen that very pointedly in the 911 fraud, and we've seen it with aggressive pig dogs like Tom DeLay and Alberto Gonzalez. And now that we have them on so many issues, from Plame to Abramoff to weapons of mass destruction, the list goes on and on. It's time to bust them, because if we don't, they're going to have the whip on us from now on. And it'll just get worse. From New York Times and Tim Golden, the United States military authorities have taken tougher measures to force-feed detainees engaged in hunger strikes at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, after concluding that some were determined to commit suicide to protest their indefinite confinement. Protest? Maybe they're just trying to end it. In recent weeks, the officials said, guards have been strapping recalcitrant detainees into restraint chairs, sometimes for hours a day, to feed them through tubes and prevent them from deliberately vomiting afterwards. Detainees who refuse to eat have also been placed in isolation for extended periods in what the official said was an effort to keep them from being encouraged by other hunger strikers. The measures appear to have had dramatic effects. The chief military spokesman at Guantanamo, Lieutenant Colonel Martin, said yesterday that the number of detainees on hunger strike had dropped from 4 to 4 from 84 at the end of December. Some officials said the new actions reflected concern at Guantanamo and the Pentagon that protests were becoming difficult to control, and that the death of one or more prisoners could intensify international criticism of the detention center. Colonel Martin said force-feeding was carried out in a humane and compassionate manner and only when necessary to keep the prisoners alive. He said in a statement that a restraint system to aid detainee feeding was being used, but refused to answer questions about the restraint chairs. Yep, that's what it said. Number to call if you have comments and helpful suggestions for defeating fascism in the United States is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, and we're opening up those phone lines now, 503-231-8187. Think Progress has obtained emails written by Jack Abramoff in which the fallen lobbyist personally describes his relationship with President Bush. They depict a relationship far more extensive than has been previously reported. The emails written by Abramoff were addressed to Kim Eisler, the national editor of Washingtonian Magazine. The Washingtonian recently reported on the existence of several photographs showing Abramoff and Bush together. Eisler is the author of Revenge of the Pequots, a book about tribal politics for which Abramoff was interviewed. In the emails, Abramoff describes meeting Bush in almost a dozen settings and details how he was personally invited to President Bush's private ranch in Crawford, Texas, for a gathering of Bush fundraisers in 2003. Abramoff did not attend, citing a religious observance. Abramoff emailed Eisler about his invitation to Crawford and his decision not to attend, and here's a quote from the email from Abramoff. No, it was that I would have to travel on Saturday, Shabbos. Yes, I was invited during the 2004 campaign. It was Saturday, August 9th, 2003, at the ranch in Crawford. That's the end of the quote of the email. The White House has continually downplayed the relationship between Abramoff and President Bush. At a January 26 press conference, President Bush said, you know, I frankly don't even remember having my picture taken with a guy. I don't know him. But according to Eisler, Abramoff told him that the two have met almost a dozen times, shared jokes, and spoke details about Abramoff's family. Now, here's another brief quote from an Abramoff email. He has one of the best, talking about Bush, he has one of the best memories of any politician I've ever met. It was one of his trademarks, though, of course, he can't recall that he has a great memory. The guy saw me in it. Almost a dozen settings and joked with me about a bunch of things, including details of my kids. Perhaps he has forgotten everything. Who knows? End quote. Jack Abramoff. Hi, you're on KBOO Press Watch. Yep, that's you on the air. Hopefully we'll try again. Okay, we're working on the magic of the dials and the buttons and the... Hi, let's try again. Hi, are you on the air?
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm pretty good.
I was listening to you talk about Abramoff. Did you catch the, I don't know, maybe you talked about it, I just tuned in, where they, on the island of Saipan, you basically have Chinese slave labor products being produced under gulag conditions with a Made in the USA label.
Made in the USA stamp, yes, a lovely thing, and prostitution and on demand for fat white politicians, and yeah.
Absolutely. I would just add a couple things to what you're saying. Have you noticed these Al-Qaeda big wigs that keep mysteriously escaping from the prisons? Did you say that? There was one here. I can't remember his name. It was just recent.
Al-Qaeda conspirators who blew up the coal who recently escaped from a prison in Yemen?
Yes.
A 40-meter-long tunnel? Yes, I would like to know more details about that. And actually, I was looking at it just before the show, but I wasn't able to get the details I want. And one of the most specific details that I would like to know is what is the construction of the tunnel, and does it resemble the tunnel constructed by the Peruvian police and the CIA during their hostage crisis? And isn't it handy that we have all these Al-Qaeda detainees out at a time when Bush desperately needs another 911-type diversion in order to go forward with, well, for example, sneaking the damn privatization of Social Security into the budget and or starting another war?
Yeah, Al-Qaeda CIA / operatives, they always escape, but they always manage to keep the goat farmers. on Guantanamo Bay, the unimportant figures. But every single time they get one of these top Al-Qaeda guys, oops, somebody opened the gates, and away they go. Hey, something on a positive note, I think they're in trouble. And I say they, I mean this administration. And the reason being, I live in a small town out in Forest Grove, and we've had a terrorism summit, supposedly, with a local police chief, totally phony, totally controlled. We also recently had a ex-CIA operative who worked in intelligence who came out and basically said nothing. It was propaganda, and she just happened to be using Iran as an example at least half a dozen times in her presentation on the NSA and the CIA, and you know how nice it is these people are spying on us. I think they're scrambling. They are really in trouble. I don't think we realize how much damage we're doing them by exposing it. And you're right. That's what we've got to do. That's the only thing we can do is keep exposing it.
Well, I think you're right. Well, thanks
for
your call.
Good job. Thank you.
I would like to comment also that now is the time to talk to, and you're not going to believe it, I'm going to say this, now is the time to talk to police. Yeah, come on. Police live amongst us. Police are our relatives. We have police unions. We need to know where people are at. Police need to be informed about just how badly the Constitution is being subverted. Police need to be reminded they have taken an oath to uphold the Constitution. Police, just like every other American, need to be reminded what is in the Constitution, especially in the Bill of Rights. And no, I'm not sneering at them. I'm just saying that this state of ignorance, which has been so carefully crafted since, oh, heck, the 20s, really, has its effect on all of us. And now that it's time for the big push, we need everyone we can get on our side. That includes members of the military, members of the police, all those people going around with guns. And, hi, we have another call. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Teresa. Just a quick comment. Regarding the humane force feeding of prisoners in Gitmo, I would suggest if people want to get an idea of what's happening there, because it's very difficult to get any info on what's happening there in our names. One good source they might want to look at is the book 10 Men Dead, The Story of the 1981 Irish Hunger Strike by David Beresford. And it describes in some detail what it's like to be interned for political crimes and what it's like to be force-fed.
Perhaps a few details about having your head wrestled so that you're facing up and a tube shoved down your nose and down your throat.
Right.
And then yanked out bloody and done again.
Right. And it's interesting to note that in Britain, it's a crime. They are not allowed to force-feed political prisoners because in the 80s, it resulted in the death of several Irish political prisoners. And subsequently, a law was passed in Britain forbidding them from doing that on humanitarian grounds.
Well, imagine that.
So, you know, anything I hear from the U.S. Army about humane force feeding is a completely ridiculous oxymoron. So just wanted to let you know about that.
Thanks for that, Mara.
Okay, take care.
Number to call, 503-231-8187. The U.S. government is developing a massive computer system that can collect huge amounts of data, and by linking far-flung information from blogs and email to government records and intelligence reports, search for patterns of terrorist activity. That's from February 9th, 2006 edition of I blew it. Okay, I don't know what that's from. Oh, Christian Science Monitor. Da-da-da, I know my source. It's much more of that. Perhaps you've heard me complaining about the dictionary echelon system, which is also being described where possible and loudly by administration officials, including Torquemada Gonzalez, as, what's their phrase? Urban legend. Oh, yeah. The New Zealanders just made it up, I'm so sure. Hi, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Hello,
Teresa.
Hi.
Hi, working cartoonist calling in here.
Oh, hey, you sent me an email to link to some commentary cartoon about the latest furor, and it's been hacked and diverted.
There's something I'm looking at right now on the Brussels Journal .com, and the first thing that I want to mention is that it's really interesting that so much ire has been raised against the Danish and Norwegian embassies abroad, but none against the French and the German embassies. And even though the French and German papers have published the cartoons without apology, and I wonder if that has anything to do with the Danish and Norwegian governments being part of the coalition of the willing occupying Iraq. Do you think so? I haven't heard that on any of the news shows. But I don't know if this has anything to do with cartoons, because I'm looking at the Brussels Journal here, and it's saying that the cartoons in the Danish papers were originally published in September, got no response, and then an imam whose name is, let's see, it's he republished them along with some faked ones and distributed them around to some of the extreme fundamentalist Muslim communities and basically stirred up the ire. So it looks like, I'm trying to find the fellow's name right now, but it kind of looks like, you know, there are lots of moderate Muslims in Europe who don't want to be bothered by these patriarchal religious zealots.
Oh, heck yeah. I mean, there's moderate... It'll come to a surprise to some people, but there's secular Muslims in my extended family who think this is all hooey. You know, I'm out of time, and so I'll have to wrap up.
Abu Laban is the imam's name who's been stirring this up. He's a Danish guy who basically wants to bring a fundamentalist patriarchal rule to Western Europe like it's being done in too many of the Middle Eastern countries.
Okay, well, thanks for your call. Well, didn't have time to talk about a couple other things. Wanted to talk more about Torquemada Gonzalez. Maybe some more of them that next week. Also, bird flu human to human? Why, yes. More on that next week. And stay tuned for more of the Incomparable Radio Zine on KBOO Portland.
And this is the Thursday Morning Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's part three of Destruction of the World Trade Center, a lecture by David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard interviews painter Rebecca Guberman-Bloom, currently showing work at the Woolley Gallery. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, more on the controversy over the publication of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. And Mary Mapes, former CBS television producer, tells her side of the story that brought down CBS Evening News anchor Dan Rather. And tune in tonight at 6 for Voices from the Middle East. The topic is Iran and nuclear weapons with Dr. Kaveh Afrasiabi, a professor and researcher at Tehran University, and Cyrus Safadari, a lawyer and political analyst. That's coming up tonight at 6 on Voices of the Middle East.